We're now three deep into the five biggest tournaments in the men's professional game. Cameron Young took the first title back in March at the Players' Championship. Just his second career PGA Tour victory, he held off Matt Fitzpatrick by a single stroke. And just 1 month later at Augusta National, Rory McIlroy became just the fourth player ever to successfully defend a Masters title. His margin is also just one shot over the world number one, Scotty Scheffler.
How about Sunday, Eamon? Aronimink, Aaron Rye earning the title in the season's second major, finishing with a clutch birdie on the 71st hole to earn his first career major in the PGA Championship. And folks, we call it the championship season these days. There you see Cam Young, there's Rory, Mr. Rye, and two more biggies to go. Shinnecock Hills next month, and then Royal Birkdale for the 2026 Open Championship. Time now, though, for another Golf Today roundtable as we welcome in GolfChannel.com senior writers Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavender. Gentlemen, it's nice to see you. Rex, I'm going to start with you. Our PGA champ finished fifth at Myrtle Beach before winning his first major. Is that an indictment of the current PGA Tour system with signature events or an affirmation of the system as you see it?
I'm going to take a page out of my colleague Lavner's playbook here and actually not give you the answer you're looking for, because I feel like it's a cautionary tale. And I know that's probably not what you were asking me about, but the idea is going forward, whatever happens with the PGA Tour schedule, there's going to be track one events and track two events. I think it's safe to say that that Myrtle Beach would be a track two event. If you have a player that's playing well, that plays his way into form, that finds something in those track two events, there has to be some sort of mechanism that allows them to move up and play these big events, not just major championships, but you're talking about all of the track one events. And I'm not quite sure how they're going to do that, because right now I would argue, based on what we've seen the last few weeks, the Aeon 10 and the Aeon 5, they can be a little messy, they can be a little clumsy, they can be a little confusing. Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, has made it clear he doesn't like clumsy and confusing. So they're going to have to get the system right, where you have a player like Aaron Rye that clearly found something in Myrtle Beach and was able to carry that over and really changed his career, changed his life, changed everything about his game by winning at the PGA Championship. You don't want to lose those stories.
Ryan, do you find it as refreshing as I do to have a major champion who's not performative in any way? He's not a lightning rod for commentary or criticism. It's just a guy who's out there devoting his life to what he's devoted his adult life to in terms of his work and getting rewarded for it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a humble, a polite, gracious, hardworking champion is certainly an antidote to what we've seen on the PGA Tour over the past couple of years, which has just been rife with strife and greed and players only looking out for themselves selfishly. And to Rex's point about making sure that the PGA Tour system has this right, I would argue that what happened at Myrtle Beach and then leading into the PGA Championship is an indictment, because you have a player in Aaron Rye who wants to change the trajectory of his career and did so by playing in that. And you need to have depth on the PGA Tour. That is the greatest strength on a week in and week out basis, is the move from limiting these fields to 72 players or 100 players was one of the, I think, the worst moves in PGA Tour history, for the sole fact that you can have a player like Aaron Rye, who has not done anything spectacular to this point in the season, but he's able to trend. We saw this with Chris Reitan as well. New Orleans, Cadillac. Then he wins the Truist Championship as well. These guys need to have a place to play. They need to have a spot to change their trajectories of their career. I hope moving forward, 2027 and beyond, we never have this limited field success, because there are great stories. There are players who are trending. They just need an opportunity to play against some of the best players in the world.
Lab, going to come back to you. From non-performative Aaron Rye to performative Bryson DeChambeau, a two-time U.S. Open champ as well, missed another cut in a major. What is going on with Bryson DeChambeau, who did not address the media last week?
Yeah, Damon, I wish we had answers. I tried to talk to Bryson DeChambeau twice on Thursday and Friday at Aronimink, and he declined requests to comment both times. It certainly seems like he's a lost figure at the moment. The driver is not nearly as much of a weapon as it used to be. The wedge play issues popped up, not just at the Masters, but also the PGA Championship as well. His putting has been more inconsistent. I just think there's big picture questions as it relates to Bryson DeChambeau and his short-term and his long-term competitive future? I think we'd all love to know an answer of whether the future uncertainty of LIV Golf and where he's going to be playing his competitive golf in 2027 is at all a distraction for him. I think it's human nature to think that it would be, but we don't know. He didn't answer questions. And actually, I could see him being muzzled for the foreseeable future after some of the comments he gave to our buddy Mark Schlabaugh of ESPN. Sort of blasting the PGA Tour and leaving up the possibility that he could simply go to a place that no real golfer has gone before, and that's to ply his trade strictly on YouTube.
Rex, what do you make of Scottie Scheffler's week out there? Never really in contention much, missed a lot of short putts. Is that something that you would define as worrisome with Scottie, or is it just symptomatic of the greens at Aronimink? Because he's not going to find any easier greens when he gets to Shinnecock in a few weeks.
I don't think there's anything wrong with Scottie Scheffler's game, specifically Scottie Scheffler's short game on and around the greens that can't be solved by going somewhere else not named Aronimink. You're right. Shinnecock Hills is going to be a difficult test as well. I would imagine the USGA is going to take a page out of Kerry Haig's book when it comes to setting up that golf course. However, I don't think anything can compare to what we saw last week. I don't know how many players told me that this is such a unique test. I think it was Rory McIlroy after his round on Thursday. They were talking about where some of the pins and some of the hole locations were, and he held up his microphone, which was rounded, and he goes, if you wanted to put a pin right here, imagine trying to play that. And that's probably what it felt like. Now, bigger picture, let's be honest. If you were going to pick on anything when it comes to Scottie Scheffler, statistically, it's his putting in round one. And I don't know that we've actually seen a turnaround on that front. I don't know if you were going to get concerned about it quite yet. It could be a statistical anomaly. But yes, certainly, by comparison to what he's done in the past, I think there is something that he needs to look into. Something's wrong on Thursday.
Lav, one of my favorite things about major championships, it's the media tent. We've got scribes from all over the world eating and complaining and talking about this and that. Was there any discussion about May versus August and the PGA Championship? Are the folks happy with the month? Is there a discussion that it needs to move back to August and be Glory's last shot?
I think there was a lot of debate. There was a lot of discussion leading into Wednesday's press conference at the PGA of America and Terry Clark. And I think the new CEO of the PGA shot that down pretty quickly, basically batting away any thought that this tournament could potentially be moved from May back to August, potentially moving it internationally to give it a little bit more shine. He leaned into the fact that, look, this works for our TV partners first and foremost. This is essentially a lull in the sports calendar. I know you have playoffs going on, the NBA and NHL, but you haven't quite reached the championship level yet. So it works for them. I think agronomically, it has proved to be a win, taking it to parts of the country that have worked, quite frankly, with Aronimink and Oak Hill. Just some of the variability that you get with the golf courses, with the grasses, certainly with the weather conditions. I mean, Eamon, you and I were both out there. We were freezing earlier in the week, and we were sweating profusely by the end of it. I think that sort of adds to the challenge. If the PGA wants to do anything, it needs to just sort of lean into its branding, which needs to be the strongest and deepest field in tournament golf. You might not have sort of the sexy branding of Glory's Last Shot, but it is inarguably the strongest and deepest field of the year. And that's the message that they want to keep pounding.
And I feel like they're still trying to find an identity. After losing Glory's Last Shot, that was a perfect fit. So I think that's a separate conversation. But if you needed a good argument of why it should stay in May versus going back to August, that was last week. For all the reasons Ryan just pointed out, the fact of the matter is the golf course played exactly the way Kerry Haig wanted it to. And when you talk to Kerry about setting up golf courses, and you can make the argument that these Northeast venues, they're going to suffer in May because if you go through a cold winter like we just experienced, you're probably not going to get the growing season you wanted to. But Kerry also pointed out that in August, he probably had more challenges just because it was at the end of the growing season. You essentially, the way he explained it to me, you were hanging on. There's also the Olympics. So once every 4 years, they were going to have to move the date anyway. So I think this is proof why it stays in May. But I did also want to point out, and Damon, you were brilliant when you said writers complaining about food. Get to my colleague's ideas when it comes to the food in the media center this week. He's got some thoughts.
We are not teeing him up on that. We'd be here all day if we started teeing up
on
that. Rex, I want to stick on this issue of sort of moving around a big championship. Shouldn't this really be Brian Rolapp's problem instead of anyone else's? Because if the players wants to assume the identity of a major, then perhaps that's the tournament that ought to move around the world and sort of be an evangelist for the game overseas, particularly if the intent for the PGA Tour is to try to develop more of a global presence and ally itself more with a DP World Tour, why shouldn't that be the one that actually moves?
Now, that makes much more sense to me. And look, Terry Clark, the new CEO of the PGA of America, was asked this question last week about maybe moving the PGA Championship internationally. That's never made much sense to me. It's the PGA of America. I'm not trying to be xenophobic here, but this is their championship. It's their organization, and they want to have it where they live and where they work. I think the Players' Championship makes a lot more sense because of the alliance with the DP World Tour. You could come up with some scenario where you play their biggest event, the Players' Championship, and the European Tour's biggest event, what would be the PMW PGA Championship, and you rotate those around. I love that idea.
Yeah, but I have trouble seeing them moving the 17th green to Barcelona, for example. We'll continue this conversation after the break and look ahead to the U.S. Open.
Now, it hasn't yet been 48 hours since Aaron Rye earned that Wanamaker trophy in this year's PGA Championship, that final round 65. But while things are still fresh, it's time to pick through the week that was by someone who was there, Joel Beale, senior writer at Golf Digest. Joel, it's good to see you. I want to start with a guy we just mentioned there, Bryson DeChambeau. You wrote a wonderful column last week on the gap that's growing between Bryson that the culture follows and Bryson the competitor in major championships, and that growing gap in terms of the results that we're seeing. Where do you think he is right now professionally?
Well, it depends what we define as professionally. I think what we think of professional golf is major tournaments and competition against the world's best. I think Bryson probably sees it in a different prism. I think he's looking at it through growing his brand on the social media apps, what he's going to do with his own equipment business that he's kind of said he wants to start. I think it also mentions what he's going to do with Liv. So that's a lot to hold on. I mean, being a professional golfer in itself is hard as it is, and not with having all these ancillary things going on. It's hard to see him as a competitor week to week, when at least when it comes to the majors. The more interesting play is, what's he going to do here in 3 months? His contract comes up at the end of August, and with Liv's future ambiguous at best, I think he still wants to be there no matter what form it takes, but that option might not exist. So it's not surprising that we're seeing his game starting to go the other way. It's a bit of a shame given how good he was just a year and a half ago. But in terms of viable, formidable golfers, I don't think Bryson's in that conversation at the moment.
Joel, this is someone who broke through on the PGA Tour with single-length irons, had dew measuring devices on greens, used to wear a Tam O'Shanter hat as a throwback. Do you see any possibility that he isn't just making a threat, that he could potentially become a future full-time YouTube golfer?
I don't think that's even a threat. I think that's probably what he wants to do. I mean, this is a guy who wants his own freedom, doesn't want to answer anybody else. It's, you know, we kind of forget when before he left originally in the 21-22 season, there were a lot of behind the scenes issues Bryson was having with the PGA Tour. So the idea that this guy would go back just because Liv is gone, you know, this he values his autonomy. I think he also likes the idea of being a trendsetter, not really answering to anybody else, and kind of showing, you know, to Bryson's credit, he has made a career out of proving people wrong. People didn't think the one-length irons would really work. He won two majors with them. The bulking up as much as he did won him open at Winged Foot. Doing all these different things with different manufacturers. You know, you look at his bag at the 24 U.S. Open. You know, it's a mix that looked like you would see it in a hacker's bag at a Thursday night men's league. And he won the hardest major there is to do. So he has proven golf wrong time and time again. I do wonder, though, if he's continued to bank on that, if it ultimately will backfire. And certainly at the moment, while I understand that's what's fueled him to this point, you wonder if the hubris and ego will finally catch up to him.
Let's move to the other end of that spectrum, away from hubris and ego. The perception of Aaron Rye is someone who's got a lot of perspective on life, a lot of gratitude, doesn't have the entitlement, doesn't have the greed. Do you think that's a fair assessment of this public image that Aaron Rye has?
Absolutely. And, you know, for every reason, golf doesn't like when the underdog wins. And yet the symmetry between what Rye was required to do at Aronimink and his own backstory, you know, staying patient, taking the punches, you know, basically betting on himself when no one else would. I mean, to me, it was beautiful. And I think it also says something about the backdrop of the last 5 years with the LIV and PGA Tour war, when everyone was worried about self-interest and greed and exclusiveness. Compare that to all the sacrifices that Rye made and were made by his family, how he treats people, what he represents and who he represents. It kind of gives you hope of what this game can be about and who for. And I think you saw that resonate with the quotes afterwards by his competitors. I think Xander Schauffele said it extremely well about how hard the guy works. You definitely heard from a lot of the Euro contingent of how he treats people. Yeah, this is one of those cases where, you know, everything you hear matches up to what he is in real life. And yeah, the last couple of days, just the resounding, the universal response has been how happy everyone has been in the game of golf for Aaron Rye.
Yeah, big win for Aaron Rye. Joel, was it a big win for the PGA of America in terms of the golf course, the setup, the town, the crowd? What were your thoughts driving away from the golf course Sunday evening?
I think overall it was a win. If I had to grade it, probably B plus. You know, I wrote a piece on Friday about the pin positions being so extreme that, you know, led to the sameness in scores that it really didn't discriminate between the great and the good and the average. Certainly a sentiment that helped when Rory and Scheffler kind of said similar things after their rounds. Obviously the wind had a big part to do with that, but that's also the Northeast in May. There's probably a bigger conversation about the upshot of uncontrolled distance gains, and there, you know, you can make the argument that's the only way you can set up a course to keep it some type of defense. I mean, early in the week, guys were claiming 16 under, 20 under would win. There's probably also something to be said about how these greens were built are not take the type of speeds the PGA of America had them. You know, not just in being aggressive with putts inside 15, 20 feet, but just how you attack it with your approach. I know patience in itself is a test, and ultimately Rye showed it was a test that could be passed. Didn't lead to maybe the most exciting golf, but overall, yeah, I think it was a win. Great crowds. I think overall the players liked the course. Philadelphia is a great golf area, both from courses available and fans. Yeah, I know there's been talk about should the PGA move this to August. I personally think May has been really good to them, and I think this was an example of what the tournament can be that might not be able to do if it moved back into the summer.
And if players didn't like the greens at Aronimink, they're in for a hell of a time at Shinnecock in a couple of weeks as well. There was a report yesterday, Joel, in Axios that said LIV Golf is seeking $250 million from private equity investors with the promise of being profitable 20 months from now. Does that seem to you realistic for a league that has burned through billions of dollars, or is there a realistic chance that the league could actually survive in some kind of zombie form, playing for pennies on the dollar compared to the $30 million purses we have been seeing?
Well, if anyone's listening, I would also like $250 million. I also do not have a business plan, but I can promise you in 20 minutes, I'll figure out some kind of answer that gets us profitability. I think you hit it at best. If LIV exists, it would look nothing like it does. I can see something of a 16-player, 24-player exhibition circuit, or I guess even more of an exhibition than it already is. Certainly, there are some guys who are locked up in contracts, as Rom has said multiple times. I think you're starting to hear more and more from agents. If LIV does take a drastic different format next year, does it suddenly, are those contracts null? I think there is still so much, as we mentioned, hubris and ego earlier. I mean, that basically expresses LIV, you know, that encapsulates LIV better than anything else. So I think there is a push to keep it going in some form just to try to prove people wrong. But I mean, as a potential competitor to the PGA Tour, if LIV goes forward with $250 million, and you know, that Axios also mentioned they could be only looking for $150 million with the hope that they get a TV media deal in some capacity or sell these teams. But if it hasn't happened now, after 5 years with Saudi backing and all the different connections the Saudi business world has with companies and private equity itself, I don't know how LIV itself would garner anything close to that. I could see it exists, but what it exists as, I don't think it's worth paying attention to.
Joel, we're all still reacting to the PGA Championship, but the game of golf never slows down. What are you most looking forward to next month's United States Open?
I mean, it's certainly one of the best venues in the world. But you drop back to what happened not only in the last time I was there, but in 2004, you know, the last two times the USGA has lost the course. I think they had very much learned their lesson, but what happens if it happens a third time? You know, this is a course the members are very much on edge about what, because, you know, ultimately looks bad on them. It essentially spurred a regime change at the USGA. I think they're better for it. I think they certainly have learned their lesson. Certainly the rapport between players and the USGA is a lot better than it's ever been. But yeah, I think everyone's kind of still waiting. Like, what happens if the course goes sideways again? Certainly, how does Scheffler, you know, does he have a chance at the Grand Slam? But yeah, I think we're in for just one of the best pure tests of golf. If we've had all these concerns about setup at Aronimink, I think this is one of the, Shinnecock's one of the few places where distance doesn't really have a role in it. Even if you look back to those first 2 days in 2018, it really was a balanced, fair test. I think that's what made Saturday so jarring. But yeah, it's a type of golf we just don't really see in the United States much, but it's as good as it gets when it comes to the National Open, and I think everyone should be excited for it.
Distance may not have a part playing Shinnecock Hills, but it's probably going to be a big debate around Shinnecock Hills that week. Joel, it's always great to catch up with you. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, guys. Have a good week.
And you, stay tuned, folks. More golf today coming your way. We'll be chatting more about our most recent major champ, Aaron Rye. Todd Lewis sat down with Aaron, and he'll join us in hour number two to get his thoughts on the week in Philly. And Todd Lewis joins us now. T. Lou, the moments after a player wins a major championship are undoubtedly a whirlwind, people pulling you this way and that. How did you find Aaron Rye's demeanor with this new brave world that he entered?
I felt like he had a definite spirit of joy, for sure, and the fact that all that he has worked at his craft since he was a kid in England has finally come to fruition, a dream is finally realized for him, but a great appreciation of all those that supported him. He mentioned his wife, Gorica, a lot, how much she has been able to mentally and emotionally guide him through some difficult times, including that Saturday night when he was in the parking lot of their hotel trying to figure out how he's going to handle the opportunity in front of him on Sunday. But yeah, I mean, this is a guy that is beloved, Damon and Eamon, as you know, on the PGA Tour, not necessarily for what he does with the golf club, but what he does with his humility, with his spirit of giving. And he had a lot of people hugging him, embracing him, congratulating him in the scoring area.
Todd, this was also a big week for the PGA of America because their last big week at the Ryder Cup didn't really go so well for the organization. But they had a new CEO, Terry Clark, who's out front, Don Rae, the president, nowhere to be seen. In the overall, do you think it was a good week for the PGA of America?
Yeah, I mean, look, the governance of the officials being there or not being there, I don't really think that's a huge deal. I think it was a really successful week for the PGA of America for a lot of reasons. Number one, it was, I think it was a well-run tournament in the city of Philadelphia. The fans were definitely into the event. I was following Scottie Scheffler along, and he heard more Eagles chants than he probably ever wants to hear, being a Dallas Cowboy fan. But they were very respectful, and he enjoyed it. He talked about how no one really got out of line. I think the course setup, I think it was brilliant. I think Kerry Haig and the PGA of America did a really nice job. And if you look at how eclectic that leaderboard was, first you got Aaron Rye, who's obviously not a bomber on the PGA Tour, a guy who plays more with his mind and accuracy. I mean, for him to win, I think that's fantastic. That says a lot about setups. I mean, when we go to the players, I think the setup at the Stadium Course or TPC Sawgrass that's put on by the PGA Tour, and you look at the winners over the years, a wide variety of styles have won, and I think there were a wide variety of styles on that leaderboard. So hats off, in my opinion, to the PGA of America and Kerry Haig for the setup. So I think it was a successful week for the organization.
Todd, you mentioned Aaron's Saturday night conversation with his wife, echoes of Scottie Scheffler's Sunday morning conversation with his wife, Meredith, before the 2022 final round of the Masters tournament, wondering, you know, what happens next? Should I win? Do you think that Aaron will be able to keep things simple as he has pre-PGA championship?
Well, he has the demeanor and the mind and the spirit to do that, but it's going to be a challenge. And we talked about that in our conversation that aired yesterday on Golf Today about how he's going to handle this new notoriety. You hear players after winning their first major championship, you hear the major championship hangover. And what is that? Some fans may think that it's a player who's achieved what he wanted to do, and that is win a major and may kind of throttle back again with the intensity. I don't think that's the case. I think it's just the opposite. As a matter of fact, J.J. Spahn and I talked about this in San Antonio when he won earlier this year. When he won the U.S. Open at Oakmont, and he's now announced on the first tee as U.S. Open champion J.J. Spahn, there is a different level of expectation for him. So externally, he's got more pressure. And I think internally, he has that too. But golf is golf. You're not perfect each and every round, much less each and every week. So when those expectations, both externally and internally, are not met, then you've got to deal with that. And that comes with a lot of doubt. And so that, in my opinion, talking to players, is the major championship hangover. How Aaron Rye deals with that and deals with those expectations now as a major champion winner, that's going to be the challenge for him.
Todd, you know better than anyone that there are a lot of stories that come up during the week of a major, and some of them are serious and some of them are quite trivial. You know, Rory's pinky toe was the prime example of that last week. But one of the interesting stories that came up was Garrick Higgle being late to the tee on Thursday. He's now since parted ways with the caddy that he had last week. You see a lot of these guys, you see some of them jogging to the tee once in a while. Who bears responsibility in this case in your mind? Is it shared equally or is it on the player?
Yeah, I think ultimately it is with the player. Obviously, the caddy is an extension of a player. We hear that all the time. As a matter of fact, it's in the rule book that the caddy is an extension of the player. Should the caddy have been where Garrick Higgle was on the putting green, maybe beside him and say, hey, man, we got to go. Let's go. That's a valid argument. But ultimately, I mean, Garrick Higgle, this is not his first ever tournament. He's played a lot around the world and he gets a sense of exactly when he should be at the tee and he just screwed up. It took him a while to maybe digest that. I think he tried to talk himself into his own guilt after the round, saying I was late, but it wasn't late and so on. But I think he kind of realizes that now, and I don't think he'll ever make that mistake again.
Tilu, another lost major championship week for Bryson DeChambeau, who did not address the media. Did you see him, see his demeanor? Do you have questions about what is going on with Bryson, a two-time major champ who seems a bit in the wilderness right now?
Yeah, you're right. Lost, right? I think he's lost a little bit with what he is going to do with his future, and it's affecting his present. I personally went up to Bryson. I know he was scheduled for a press conference, and then that didn't happen. And I asked him if he would give us a few words prior to the first round, and he simply said, I can't. It's not that he said, I'm sorry, I won't be able to right now. It's just, I can't. I found that to be interesting. And he said it again after his second round, too, to the assembled media, I can't talk to you. And I think that's, I mean, that word can't is interesting because I feel like, this is just my opinion, that he said a lot of things the week prior that may have put himself not in the best position as he tries to either figure out what he's going to do with LIV or if there is an avenue that he wants to take on the PGA Tour. And so he kind of got, you know, he muzzled himself or got muzzled, however you want to say it, but he just didn't talk. And I think that is a huge distraction for him right now. Look, we all want to be liked. We all do. There's no doubt about it. But I think Bryson feeds off that energy more than maybe any other person that I know, certainly more than any player I know. And when he said the week prior to the PGA Championship about going back to the PGA Tour, if the membership wants me back, you remember that? It's quite an interesting sentence from him. He was kind of, I feel like, putting a weather balloon up to see if he is indeed welcomed back or liked by the PGA Tour membership. So, yeah, I think he is distracted for sure.
What do you make of the week for the top three players in the world out there, Todd? You know, Scotty seemed to be missing a lot of putts. Rory's missing a lot of fairways. Cameron Young missing an overall sharpness in his game. Do you think any of them leave feeling particularly positive about the week at Aronimink?
I think both Cameron Young and Scotty Scheffler feel kind of neutral. I mean, they weren't at their, I mean, their highest. They weren't peaking in all levels of their game that we have seen early in the PGA Tour season. I don't think Rory McIlroy has that much to hang his head about. I mean, I think he had a bad day on Thursday and probably underestimated the difficulty of the golf course, especially in those conditions, shooting that 76. But for him to take ownership of that and go to the range and figure out his driving issues specifically and put up one heck of a fight. He mimicked Scottie Scheffler, what we have seen over the last few months, been having a poor round, but fighting back and putting himself into contention. I think that's pretty admirable. And I don't think he's got that much to hang his head on.
T. Lou, we've got U.S. Open qualifying happening around the globe, weeks away from the third major championship of the season. What is storyline number one for you as you look ahead to Shinnecock Hills?
Well, it's Scottie Scheffler. I mean, he's got the chance to do what Rory McIlroy did last year, and that is complete the career Grand Slam and do it on a golf course that I think sets up for him perfectly. It's going to depend on how the wind is going to blow, but obviously that is a ball striker's gauntlet he has to figure out, and he's the best in the business at it. So that's the primary focus for me is, can Scottie Scheffler handle that pressure of trying to win the U.S. Open and trying to complete the Grand Slam, which I think he can. He's pretty good about cocooning himself and not listening to the noise around him. So I think that's going to be the primary story and how he handles that pressure, because obviously it's not very easy, especially in your first go around, to try to complete the career Grand Slam. But that's my number one story.
Are you ready to talk a lot about distance that week as well, Todd? Because it seems that the governing bodies are likely to make this announcement on the one date for both recreational and professional golfers to play with a new ball at some point before Shinnecock, which kind of leads me to think that that week is going to be consumed with a lot of distance talk.
Well, we've heard it a lot on the PGA Tour and elsewhere. Yeah, look, I mean, I tell you, it's interesting that, you know, Rex Hager did a great job in this great report that he put out, and the fact that Cameron Young is playing with a golf ball that would be conforming under the new regulations by the USGA and the RNA with the, quote, rollback, that he is performing with a ball that he likes that could work very well for him, but will it work well for others? So, that's a feather in the USGA and the RNA's cap, I feel like. So I think we're going to hear a lot about it. You guys know we've talked to a majority of players on the PGA Tour, and they are really not that much into the rollback. I know as amateurs, I mean, I need a harder ball that can fly, because I'm going backwards. I don't think I'm ever going to quit the game and say, man, this is too easy. I'm going to take up fishing. And I don't know any other amateurs as well. So it's going to be quite the interesting week. But it sounds like the USGA and the RNA are full steam ahead.
Maybe the USGA and RNA will carve out a special category for 50-somethings to get a little extra distance off the tee. T. Lou, great job last week, and great interview with Aaron Rye as well. We appreciate a few minutes.
Always enjoyed talking with you guys. Thank you.
Stick around. More golf today coming your way. Cool story coming out of local qualifying for the U.S. Open. Twin brothers both punching their tickets to golf's longest day. Alex and Max Herman are both closer to playing in the national championship. They join us next. Back on golf today, reminder, getting closer to the U.S. Open. And on Monday, June 8th, Golf Channel will have 11 live hours. 11. Golf's longest day presented by Titleist. You won't want to miss the action as players earn their way or not to Shinnecock Hills. Here are the U.S. Open Final qualifying sites around the country and Canada. Del Paso, CC, in the state capital of California. A lot of returning sites as well. Lambton Golf and Country Club, Springfield, and Woodmont. The North Course back in action as well. Cool story, by the way, to look out for in final qualifying. 30-year-old twin brothers, Alex and Max Herman, who are both alumni of the Georgia State men's golf team, both advanced in the final qualifying after great performances at Raven Golf Club in Sandestin in Florida. Alex placed first. Max placed tied for third. They can get the job done. And Alex and Max join us now. Alex, I'm going to start with you. I'm the father of triplets. They play tennis. My wife and I struggle deciding whether to put them in the same tournament or not. How do you, Alex, go about deciding when you and your brother are going to play in the same tournament or not, as you did in this case?
That's a great question. I think sometimes when it makes sense for us, like, for example, in Q schools, we split up so that the other one can caddy for the brother playing. But most other tournaments, I mean, it's an individual sport. You're mainly looking at your own game, your own score. We sign up together so that we can travel together and cut expenses a little bit. And it's also good to have some company on the road.
Max, we've had the Højgaard twins on the show before, and they talked about the competitiveness between them, and their rule was no punching in the face. That's how competitive it got with those guys. What's the level of competition like between you guys growing up and today?
I don't think I've violated that rule either, but it's obviously a very friendly competition, and he's always somebody that I want to do well. He's pushed me in practice and competition to get better, but at the same time, I really want him to do well. So it's not really, I don't think you can say rivalry. It's really just somebody that you have with you all the time that makes you better. And at the same time, I'm really rooting for him. So especially in local qualifying, when I saw that he shot 5 under and that he won, I was very happy. And I was obviously also happy that I played well. So that was a really good and fun day for us.
Alex, how did two kids from Germany end up at Georgia State, now living in Atlanta?
I would have to credit our former golf coach, Joseph Inman. He played on the PGA Tour for 15 years, I believe, and on the Champions Tour for that. He went over to watch me play at the British Boys Championship in Royal Liverpool in England. And I talked to him. We definitely wanted to go somewhere south with better weather than Germany. And they had a very good competitive team at the time, so it was a perfect fit for us, and we haven't looked back since. It's been a great time. We still are in good touch, good contact with him and our teammates, and so we really enjoyed the time here.
How similar are you guys, Max, in terms of, does your golf swing look the same? Do you have very similar approaches to the game?
That's actually a funny one, because I think golf-wise, we're very opposite. And I think initially when I had to caddy for him, that was I always wanted him to do what I thought was best, and that's really not what works for him. I think his miss is more left, my miss is more right. Funny enough, you mentioned the Højgaard twins. I've watched a YouTube video on them, and they've kind of talked about those opposites too. So I guess you can be twin brothers, have very similar DNA, and golf still finds a way to make you completely opposite players. But that being said, I mean, some stuff is still like fairly similar. And some short game and all that kind of stuff, we both have to work on it together to improve.
Alex, there's another set of identical twin brothers from Germany, the Pauls, Yannick and Jeremy. Please tell me that at some point in the past decade or 20 years, the four of you have gotten together and played golf somewhere, two sets of identical twins.
There's a great story to that. We played a college event at Bandon Dunes, and there's a shotgun start, and I believe it's the third hole, a par three on Pacific Dunes, and Max played with Yannick in group 3A, and I was with Jeremy in group 3B. And the two kids from Oregon State couldn't believe their eyes when they saw two sets of twins all speaking German on the tee box. So that was quite funny. But no, we grew up playing with them in state championships, played on the German national team together. So they're good friends of ours. We definitely look up to them. They've done very well for themselves, and we always cheer for them when they play on the DP or PGA Tour.
You guys are out there obviously getting in some prep for golf's longest day coming up on June 8th. Max, do you allow yourself to dream far enough ahead to the possibility of a tee time at Shinnecock Hills?
I would say yes and no. I played last year in it, and I've seen how hard it is. There's so many good players. Obviously, you show up with that dream in mind, but then you got 36 holes in between you and that goal, and there's really a lot of work to be done. And it sounds probably very stereotypical, but it starts with the first tee shot, and you just got to see what you got that day and get the most out of it. And then hopefully, you know, coming down the stretch, the last 4 or 5 holes, when you're close, you'll definitely know it and feel it. And that's, I guess, what everyone plays for. That's super exciting. I also love the show, watch the coverage every year, whether I'm playing or not. And it's a super exciting day, and we're pumped to be a part of it.
Well, we appreciate you watching Golf's Longest Day. Alex, it looks like you're both wearing blue shirts, but you have a little more facial hair. Any time in the past where you guys have done a practical joke on a teacher or on your parents, kind of trying to get folks mixed up on who you actually are?
All the time. I mean, if you have twins in your family, you know about that. I even react to when people call me Max. When sometimes I get a mean look on a putting green after someone says hi to me and they've just played with my brother, so I'm not being rude. I just haven't met the person yet. So it happens all the time. For us, we're in blue today. That was not planned. Sometimes, you know, he walks out of his room, I walk out of mine, and we look similar. It's not the best thing that can happen, but sometimes it happens. And you just learn to live with it. At the end of the day, it's fun to have a twin. And if that's one of the downsides, then I'll gladly deal with it.
Well, journalists are supposed to be objective, but as a father of multiples, I'll be rooting for you both. Thanks for your time and best of luck on Golf's Longest Day.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Well, coming up, we're going to check in on this week's PGA Tour stuff. In Texas, there's another identical twin right on the range there at TPC Craig Ranch. Rasmus Højgaard, his brother Nikolaj, taking a couple of weeks off back in Denmark, but Rasmus trying to play his way into the United States Open as well. We check in with Amy Rogers on the other side of this break. We're back in golf today, and the countdown continues to the season's third major on the men's side, Shinnecock Hills, hosting the United States Open. First round action gets underway on June 18th. And that's one of a pretty stout slate of USGA venues this year. Of course, the women's open in June at Riviera, just across town. The Curtis Cup at Bel Air Senior Open, Scioto in Ohio as well.
How about earlier this month, Eamon? Morgan Ellison and Katie Scheck won the U.S. Women's Amateur Four-Ball Championship on the first hole of the Sudden Death Playoff at Daniel Island, Ralston Creek Course. The win, the duo made some history as the oldest winners of the championship at just 23. And it got tense and emotional at the end, as you can see. And a lot of cool goodies come with winning. Beautiful trophy, gold medal for each player, and that trophy you get custody for a year, 10-year exemption from qualifying for the U.S. Women's Amateur Four Ball, provided the side remains intact, an exemption in the U.S. Women's Amateur at the Honors Course in Ottawa, Tennessee, and their names inscribed on a beautiful plaque recognizing all the winners of the USGA. 2026, we got Morgan and Katie joining us now. Ladies, congratulations. Morgan, I want to start with you. How would you describe the tension and the drama? I mean, Snyder makes birdie on 17. It got a little tight there down the stretch.
Oh, yeah, it did for sure. It was exciting. I had a putt on 16 to try to push us to two up, and then on 17 to tie. So it was some tense moments, some pressure putts, but it was all exciting. And when we stepped on the 19th tee, I was like, hey, we're here again. We're in this spot. We would have taken that at the beginning of the week. So it was exciting.
And Katie, we noticed that in the list of goodies that come with winning this title is exemptions for both of you into the U.S. Women's Amateur later this year. That's a big deal for you. That's in your hometown where the Honors Course is. How much was that on your mind during the course of this week?
I knew it was a possibility that if we won, I'd get the exemption. And it's been a goal of mine to get to compete in the U.S. Women's Am, as is a lot of people's goal. But I just trusted my partner and I, and I knew that if we made the pots and hit the shots that we needed to do, it was looking good that we could probably get our exemption into this amateur.
Now, Katie, I saw some pictures in the aftermath of the victory, and I'm just going to poke a little fun at you. You were in tears. You were a mess. You were emotional. Just how would you describe that moment? It was just really neat to see.
The first thing I felt was kind of like just that relief, because I would say, except for two of our matches, Morgan and I, we had to play extra holes for every match. Same when we first ever qualified for the USGA four ball. So we were used to having to play extra holes. And because, I mean, our earlier round when we finished, because we had to finish on Wednesday morning in our semifinals. And it took the last hole. It was 22 holes to finish that match. And then we had to go right into playing our morning match on Wednesday. And so it was just kind of this unbelievable feeling that, oh my gosh, we did it. We survived. We kicked some butt out there and we get to take home this amazing accomplishment.
Morgan, you're the oldest winners of this championship. There's been, I guess, 11 playings of it. You're only 23 years old, but you're taking on a couple of 15-year-olds in the final. Does that just make you kind of feel like a grizzled old veteran out there at 23?
Yeah, I think we definitely both had experience. I mean, both Katie graduating college this year and me finishing the year before, I think we both have a lot of experience. But yeah, we definitely felt old. One of my friends that was there this week kept calling me Grandma. She's like, I was like, hey, Grandma's hanging around. We're making it. So yeah, it's exciting to have our names in the history book as the oldest ever.
Well, Katie, you still got a lot of runway left. What's the future look like for you? What else do you want to accomplish in this great game?
Well, I want to get into college coaching. So that is currently on the agenda at the moment. I want to be an assistant coach somewhere. And this summer, I'm actually working for our local Sneds Junior Golf Tour out of the Chattanooga branch. I worked with them last summer and I had an absolute blast working with all the junior golfers. And it's kind of my way of giving back to such an amazing game and, you know, trying to provide some of the same opportunities to the next generation coming up, just as the way like the golf community has embraced me and giving me all the amazing opportunities that I have had in my entire golf career.
Morgan, you're exempt into this tournament for a lot of years to come. Is there any chance that we're going to see the team try to retain the title next year?
I would definitely say we're planning on next year. 10 years is a lot, so we'll see coming down the road. My dad made a joke about how old he would be caddying for my last one in 10 years, but we'll see. We're definitely excited probably to tee it up next year.
Well, it's fun to watch you guys go about your business. Katie and Morgan, a.k.a. Grandma, congratulations on getting the job done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Oh, you got it. How about another look at the winners with the emotion and the tears and the hugs and ultimately the hardware to boot.